Hey man, how's it going, y'all? I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. My voice sounds like this because I'm sick and I've been doing radio all morning. I was on Ernie's show. Thanks, Ernie. And then I did Jason Stapleton's program. Hopefully pick up a couple of new listeners. Ow, I bit my tongue. Hopefully pick up a couple of new listeners out of that one. Yeah. So, yeah, that's cool. Hey, man, guess what? So today, we're going to have Chris Woods back on the show. This guy, man, he does such important work. He was at the Bureau for Investigative Journalism, and now he's at airwars.org. And what he does is he counts the killed as best he can in the American and coalition war against the Islamic State. Previously, his specialty was Afghanistan-Pakistan region, although I don't mean to speak too soon or out of school. I don't know if that's still going on or not. It might be. Anyway, I don't know who could keep track of them all. There's so many wars going on. Whether we're fighting for Al-Qaeda or against them, we're making them bigger and bigger all the damn time. I know that. Then Gareth is going to be on. There's a new IAEA report out. Finally, the IAEA report has come out on the possible military dimensions. The PMD. Oh my God, what does it say? According to the Wall Street Journal, it says the Iranians had been lying and that they had been working on nuclear weapons. Oh, yeah? Well, we'll see about that. Gareth Porter will be on the show today. And yeah, that's three in 1 week, but it ain't my fault. He's good on everything. Don't blame me. All I'm doing is interviewing the people who write the best stuff, and he consistently writes the best stuff, day in, day out. Gareth Porter, the greatest reporter in America. Well, okay. He's pretty damn awesome. It depends exactly how you measure it. But certainly to me, he is the most indispensable. You know, Iraq, Iran, Afghanistan, Syria, wrote the book on the nuclear program. Debunked the whole damn surge. Both of them. The great Gareth Porter. He'll be back on the show today. And John B. Carroll. I guess he's got outrage of the week here. As many as 1,000 black men imprisoned on planted drug evidence in Henry County, Alabama. And John B. Carroll has got the documents to prove it. Oh, wait, that's not today. I forgot. He's got CNN came up, and now that's going to be on Monday. Oh, good. Then I'll have extra time to complain about stuff I want to complain about. Oh, man, I even had a note to myself to try to get the drone guys. Hey, chat room guys, remind me at the break to try to look up the drone guys again. You know, I tried to email them. You know, there's new whistleblowers. There's the one guy. There's two of them have already been out for a little while. Now they got two more. The four drone whistleblowers. They did this great thingamajig there with Amy Goodman in New York on Democracy Now. And I emailed them and didn't get a response, but I'd like to try again. I got very important stuff to say. And you know, we're running a blog on antiwar.com right now by, I think it's John Hanrahan. About how the damn New York Times, man, they won't even cover four young drone whistleblowers coming forward to talk about how they're killing people, innocent people. And now it's wrecking their lives, too. They hadn't been shot at, but they have been made to do horrible things. And the New York Times just won't cover it. That's not fit to print. Just the same as the drone war scoop by The Intercept. I really wish Greenwald had just stayed at The Guardian. But anyway, The Intercept only other journalists read The Intercept, right? Like, it doesn't have mass appeal to everyone. It's new, and I don't know. If other journalists pick up what's going down at The Intercept, then it might get out there. But if it's just at The Intercept, it's just at The Intercept. Let's be honest, you know? Greenwald's joint I'm talking about over there. Well, so, the New York Times won't cover the drone papers. Somebody leaked, I forgot how many pages of documents, that they wrote up 10 good articles. 10 good articles at The Intercept based on what they call the drone papers. Again, completely blacked out by the New York Times other than a short couple of paragraphs at the end of an article about something else. It really is like, you know, Itzhar Tass or Pravda back in the Soviet Union. You know? And the thing is, for you and me, it's kind of hilarious because, hey, we see right through you. But for the American people, they don't. If it's not in the New York Times, then it's not on the top of the hour news. It's not on the nightly newscast. It's not important. Just like the war in Yemen. America's been killing Yemen for 9 months now. But TV won't tell you about it. And if they do it all, they'll say it's Saudi doing it. And they'll say it's important because the Houthis are backed by Iran or some slogan. And that'll be the end of that. It's really amazing. You know, this is one of the things that made me a political kook. Well, I look back with political kook goggles. But I remember learning when I was in high school, probably ninth grade. That when TV did a big summer-long scare tour about the Crips and the Bloods, young black super predators with fully automatic weapons coming to kill you and sell crack to your children. Way! They did that all summer long in 1988. Maybe it was 89. All summer long. And the polls showed, the question was, what do you think is the biggest problem facing America today? And drugs had been like number 13 or 14 on the list. And then they did their summer of fear of young black super predators with fully automatic weapons and crack. And then all of a sudden drugs, illegal drugs was the number one issue facing the people of the United States of America, according to the people of the United States of America. And then, guess what? When the propaganda campaign subsided, illegal drug use went right back down to number 13 or 14 on the list. That is how impressionable people are. All the way impressionable. As impressionable as you could draw them to be in a comic book if you had the talent. That's how impressionable. That's how easy to manipulate. That's Dan Sanchez's article today, in fact, at antiwar.com, right? Is, where the hell is it, dude? Nothing to fear but the fearful themselves. Terrorists aren't going to kill you. But that ain't stopping people from believing that we're all under threat. It could happen to any of us at any time. And then, therefore, because of their fear, because their emotions run wild, their minds have just stopped. As the heroic Bill Hicks put it back an eon ago. And so then you can just fill them with whatever nonsense. And they'll rationalize the parts that don't make sense, because they're scared. I don't know. Seems like right now would be a great opportunity for Ron Paul to announce he's running for president again and start teaching the truth to people. They really, really need it, you know? I mean, he has a daily show. It's great. It's just not enough. All right, we'll be right back in just a sec, y'all. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime future freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, what's more of a mess? The Washington Times website or MSNBC TV? MSNBC right now live has a reporter rummaging through the apartment in San Bernardino where the massacre guy lived. What? There's not a cop standing out front? Or do they tell him, yeah, go ahead, poke around. We're done in there, pal, or what? Are you kidding me?
Here's just some mixed nuts with peanuts.
Yeah, total jackassery. Look, they had peanuts. Before, he went to check the calendar on the wall, but he only went forward in time, not back. Oh, good shot of the baby's crib there. This jackass. Anyway, sorry. Jackassery all around me. But also, Washington Times, God, their website is such a disaster. It is just an absolute disaster, dude. Holy crap. And you know what's funny is their printer pages are perfect. But to get to their printer page, Jesus. Guys, you're bumming me out. Let's see here. Oh, that's not it. I'm trying to find the four-part series. The Kelly Riddell four-part series for Jason Stapleton here. I got two of the four. Anyway, so yeah, man, it's my show. Coming up, like I say, Chris Woods and Gareth Porter will be on. I'm going to talk about Donald Trump's fascism and the California thing in a second here, but I got to say this about Hillary Clinton. You know what a rat effer is? I'm trying to be polite and not say the term. That's like dirty tricks, Nixonian dirty tricks, right? You send someone, someone who is a rat effer is someone who does dirty tricks on behalf of a presidential campaign kind of thing. I think. I mean, maybe I have that wrong, but yeah, I don't think so. Like when the girl that worked for George, Jeb Bush went and said to Donald Trump, oh, well, you hurt my feelings as a woman because I'm a woman and my feelings are hurt or whatever. Remember that? And then it turned out she was working for Jeb Bush all along. That's what she is. That's what she will always be remembered as for the rest of her life. A rat effer. And anyway, it's her 15 minutes. It's the most notable thing about her entire existence on this planet. Isn't that great? What a great person. Anyway, so somebody sent one of these rat effers yesterday to get at Hillary Clinton, and it was beautiful, man. And the problem is she mispronounced everybody's name. For God's sake, I think she even mispronounced Paula. Was it Jones or Paula that she got wrong? Palua or something. Stupid idiot. Oh, wait, now that I think about it, I got the clip here, don't I? Wait, let me play the clip, because it's much more funnier if you play the clip. Oh, but you know what? I'm going to have to deal with stupid freaking windows to move the clip from where it is to where I want it. Now, hang on a minute. I am determined, you see. I'm going to play this clip. And why? For yucks. That's why. Because it makes me happy. It makes me happy. Hang on. God dang it. All right. You ready? Here we go.
Say that all rape victims should be believed, but would you say that about Johnita Broderick, Kathleen Wiley, and or Paula Jones? Should we believe them as well?
Well, I would say that everybody should be believed at first until they are disbelieved based on evidence.
Okay, so a couple of things there. Yeah, it's not Johnita, you stupid idiot. It's Juanita. You ever heard that? Yeah. Them Hispanics, they're crazy the way they use their J's. It's different from you. Did you know that? Fully grown adult? You stupid idiot, Johnita, really? And who are the idiots who put her up there without making her practice how to say Johnita correctly? Damned fool. And then Kathleen Willey, again, just like presidential candidate Ben Carson had never heard of Hamas yesterday, and in front of the Republican Jewish Committee kept calling him hummus. She's never heard of Kathleen Willey before. This person who's asking this very challenging question of Hillary Clinton has never heard of the people in her question before. For God's sake, rehearse it once. Rehearse it. Okay, she did pronounce Paula Jones right. Jesus, what a stupid, pathetic idiot. Can you imagine the most notable thing about your life is that you're a rat effer on behalf of the Republicans doing dirty tricks against Hillary Clinton, and you can't even pronounce Juanita or Willie? It's Willie, you damned fool, not Wiley. It's got two L's. God. But anyway, sorry, I digress, because the point is, did you hear her question? Hey, Hillary Clinton, Juanita Broderick says your husband Bill Clinton raped her and bit her on the face like a savaged animal. Do you think that she should be believed? And Hillary Clinton answered yes.
Say that all rape victims should be believed, but would you say that about Johnita Broderick, Kathleen Wiley, and or Paula Jones? Should we believe them as well?
Well, I would say that everybody should be believed at first until they are disbelieved based on evidence.
Yeah, that's right. And nobody has ever shown, and oh, I can't wait for all the follow-ups on Hillary Clinton. Do you have any evidence that would, you think, lead a fair-minded person to disbelieve Juanita Broderick? And the only thing lucky about Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton on the Juanita Broderick story is that nobody knows about it. Because her name didn't finally become public until after he was acquitted in the U.S. Senate. Many of those guilty votes, by the way, came from them reading her testimony in front of the grand jury. But she was always known as Jane Doe number 4 and this kind of thing. They wouldn't say who she was or what was her story. And even though she did an interview with Lisa Myers from NBC, who had been harassing her for years for an interview, she finally went on the record, and then NBC held the interview for weeks during Bill Clinton's impeachment trial in the Senate. Held the interview! And then it wasn't until the Wall Street Journal editorial page finally wrote about it that they aired the interview. After it was too late, after he was acquitted, they aired the interview. And unlike Paula Jones, who did not give in to Bill Clinton, she was not raped, Bill Clinton intimidated her and sexually harassed her with his superior government executive position over her at the time, and attempted to intimidate her into giving him sexual favors, but she refused. So what he did to her was wrong. I don't know if it was criminal, but it was certainly, you know, mean. Kathleen Willey, he assaulted. Kathleen Willey, he cornered in the White House pantry and felt her up. Forced her hand to feel him up. That's a crime. But Juanita Broderick, he punched in the face, and he threw her down, and he tore open her pantyhose, and he raped her for all a half a minute, and he savagely bit her on the face like an animal. And then he left her crying and said, "You better put some ice on that, darling," as he left. And you go watch the video. And now I'm out of time for this segment, damn it, but I'll be right back. We're going to talk more about this in a minute, because there's more to it. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday. And The Future of Freedom with FFF Founder and President Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. Man. Hey, guess what? We got Chris Woods back on the show here, formerly with the Bureau for Investigative Journalism, and now at Air Wars. That's airwars.org. Welcome back to the show, Chris. How are you, man?
I'm good. How are you, Scott? It's been a busy week here, but lots going on, and very busy for everyone at Air Wars, but getting lots of traction for once on civilian casualties, so people paying attention where often that's a subject they don't want to talk about, as you know.
Yeah. Well, talk about the traction. What traction are you getting?
Well, the big story over here in the UK after Paris has been, first of all, obviously the French have really shifted up their activities against so-called Islamic State, Daesh. They've sent an aircraft carrier group into the Mediterranean and seem to have increased their tempo quite a bit. And so have some of the other partners, actually. The Australians have just put some data out saying they've doubled the number of airstrikes they carried out last month. So I suspect we've seen quite a few partners responding to those French calls for more action against Islamic State. And then here in Britain, the big story this week is we've had a parliamentary vote on whether to extend our airstrikes from Iraq into Syria. That's been a really contentious issue here in the UK. 2 years ago, Prime Minister David Cameron tried to get Parliament to enable airstrikes, not against Islamic State at that time, but actually against the Assad regime. And that was blocked 2 years ago. This time around, he won with a very comfortable majority. The majority of MPs here have voted for airstrikes. And within hours, the British were bombing in Syria. So a big shift here and in Europe more generally. Much more aggressive stance towards Daesh since Paris.
Yeah. And then so... Well, now, here's the thing. A lot of idiocy broke out all over the place after Paris in Europe and in the United States of America. And people are so frustrated, Chris, as you know, with this thing just dragging on and on. The French have clamped down and started doing, you know, door-to-door searches or closing down mosques and all this horrible stuff. But at the same time, I've been very pleased to see, I think I would expect that you've been probably pretty pleased to see as well, that there have been a lot of writers, particularly on the left, but even some conservatives and, of course, the libertarians, who haven't forgotten that the history of the 21st century up until now actually exists, or, you know, did, and that it has some bearing on what's going on now. And there have been, you know, surprisingly, especially with kind of the demonic nature of the Islamic State, where they're the perfect boogeyman that they always pretended Saddam was, kind of thing, you know, there's a lot of people who are really reluctant to go back to war over there, who seem to really be learning the lesson that, you know, our intervention has caused this up until now. And even with an enemy this bad, we're not buying into the idea that more intervention is going to get rid of them. At least not without creating somebody worse in their wake. So do you think there's a bit of progress along those lines?
You're usually the one who accuses me of being the optimistic one. I have to say I see it quite a bit more pessimistically than that at the moment, mainly because, we are at war in both Syria and Iraq. And for all the talk, we've been bombing an awful lot there for the last 60 months. Sure. We're just waiting for the latest figures from CENTCOM, but I'm absolutely sure that we are going to pass the 30,000 bombs and missiles mark by the end of November. And in fact, our own numbers show there were more airstrikes carried out in November across Iraq and Syria than in any month so far in this war. So it's amplifying. It's getting heavier. The number of civilian casualties continues to climb, although the coalition will barely talk about them. You probably saw that it's only a couple of weeks ago that they've just admitted that they've killed four civilians in Iraq. Those were the first admissions of civilian deaths in Iraq in 15 months of bombing. So, you know, there is a very intense war going on right now. And I know that the question is, should we be more or less involved in that war? Should there be ground troops or whatever? But the reality is this is a heavy war, and it's getting heavier.
Yeah. I guess all I was saying is the people aren't all quite as terrorized and whooped up as they were in, say, 2002 or something like that. But they've gone to being for, you know, bloodthirsty revenge to just not caring either way, really, and just sort of indifferent, I think. That's really not much of an improvement, really.
Yeah. The one thing that is interesting, though, that, you know, there's a sort of cold fury to what we're seeing from these increased airstrikes. We're not tracking a significant rise in civilian casualties to go along with this greater number of airstrikes. And there is something to what they're saying, that they're taking a huge amount of care not to kill civilians, particularly when you compare it to the Russians. You know, the Russians are killing a heck of a lot of civilians relative to the coalition. But, of course, we're still killing the civilians in both Iraq and Syria, and our military is still telling us they're not. So same old on that score.
Well, you know, is it really the case, do you think, that the rules of engagement are designed just to protect the administration from the PR problems of killing civilians, kind of uber alles here? Because their bombing campaign has been so restricted, in a sense, that they're being accused of, you know, it's playing into the idea that they want the Islamic State to continue to thrive. They're still not crying oops, even after the fall of Mosul, even after two attacks on Paris. They still prefer the Islamic State checking Iranian power in the region. And so they're kind of pussyfooting around the edges. And especially when compared to the Russians, who are getting in there and taking out the convoys of oil to Turkey and seem to actually be pursuing their stated goal rather than just bombing for no good reason at all, which is more like what the American coalition seems like they're up to.
I mean, it is always a political decision how many civilians you're prepared to kill. It's something I write about in the book quite a lot. There's a chapter there in my book which is called The Inconstant Value of a Civilian Life. And you would think in war that, you know, the value of a civilian life is absolute, but of course it changes all the time. There was a story in Stars and Stripes just a couple of days ago saying the administration has decided that in the airstrikes on high-value targets in Iraq and Syria, they're going to risk killing more civilians. So that's a decision they're taking. They will take the chance of killing more civilians by being more aggressive in those strikes. And this is one of the problems for civilians, of course. Depending on who's bombing you and at what stage in the cycle, you are at greater or lesser risk. So, yes, it's a political decision. Yes, it's Obama responding to politics, but that's worked in the past. You know, the biggest thing that brought down civilian casualties from CIA strikes in Pakistan was the political and media pressure that Obama came under. And if that pressure hadn't come, they'd have kept on killing those civilians. So I think it's always going to be a political choice. Mm-hmm. But it starts to get a little bit ugly when you have politicians debating the value of a civilian life. And then at the extreme end of that spectrum, and I do mean extreme end, you've got Donald Trump at the moment advocating the deliberate bombing of the families of Islamic State leaders. Now, let's be absolutely clear what Trump is talking about here. He's talking about committing war crimes. You cannot lawfully, deliberately target civilians in war. That is a war crime. And yet here's Donald Trump advocating we kill, you know, the wives and children of militant and terrorist leaders. This is shocking stuff.
I'm sorry, Chris, but let me interrupt you here just for a second to prove it, because that might sound like something that you had made up if people hadn't heard that before. It's so ridiculous that that couldn't possibly be true. And yet, no, really, here it is. He said it on Fox and Friends. You can watch the video and read all about it at thehill.com. The headline is Trump on Terrorists. You have to take out their families. And you know how he likes to repeat himself. He kind of says it over and over again there the last little bit. Makes it very clear what he's talking about. And just think, he doesn't even have the slightest bit of cognitive dissonance about that either. You know, you do what you want to do. Who ever heard of a law that would prevent a government from doing what they want to do, to prevent him from doing what he wanted to do? I'm sorry, we got to take this break. Hold tight, everybody. We'll be right back with the great Chris Woods right after this. Sorry. Can't say Chris, for Christ's sake. I got a cold. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
But we're fighting a very politically correct war.
Yeah. But we see
and
that
the other thing
in
is with the terrorists, you have to take out their families. When you get these terrorists, you have to take out their families.
There you go. That's Donald Trump. Front runner. In the lead, not just over the Republicans, but in all the head-to-head polls against Hillary Clinton as well. Front runner for president of the United States right now. Oh, we'll just kill their kin.
Yeah. Was there any kickback, Scott, in the U.S. media? And did people use that term, war crime? I mean, did it come up at all? Or?
Oh, I don't know. No, I don't think they paid much attention to it. I mean, honestly, I think that probably, I hate to give them credit or like spin in their favor or anything, but I bet maybe they're afraid that they're just going to help advertise the idea. It'll only backfire. Yeah. You know, the worse this guy is, the more the American right loves him. And, you know, I think Hillary is such a poor candidate that she's probably the only one he could beat in the general to actually win the election. But we could have a President Trump, man.
I mean, blimey.
And when
blimey.
He says stuff like, yeah, just round him up and put him up against the pole and shoot him, that's what they like. You know, a solution they can understand. You know, kill them all and then they'll all be dead, right? And then end of argument. Okay, great.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. So thank you. You're really cheering me up for my weekend here, Scott. Yeah.
Hashtag yeah. Conservatism. That's what it is, man. And, you know, I can understand, again, people are frustrated that this is still going on and they cannot possibly associate the governments that are responsible for getting us into this mess that they associate with themselves with the cause of the problem. So it's got to be the other guy's fault. And no matter how many of them we kill, they keep attacking us. So I guess we just got to kill way more of them. And they don't have a bunch of other alternative explanations to weigh against. You know what I mean? That's basically all they have. Radical Islam is coming to get us, and Obama won't even stop them. What is he doing?
Yeah. I mean, we're seeing quite a lot of that reflected over here. But
All right. Well, and I know that when I read the British press, they're a lot more honest about. Well, actually, The Guardian withheld opinions like this for 3 days. Did you see that? They made an official editorial decision and admitted it, that they wouldn't let anyone say that French foreign policy had anything to do with the Paris attack until at least 3 days had passed, which is just incredible to me.
I missed that.
Yeah. There's a blog about it, anti-war.
Very sensitive here as well. The former mayor of London, Ken Livingstone. I mean, he was mayor when the suicide bombers hit the London Underground and the bus, if you remember, about 10, 11 years ago now. And he said that there was a direct link between their suicide attack and Iraq. And the media here went crazy about that and have really been shouting him down. And that's been very interesting. But, you know, whether you like it or not, there is often a causal connection between these terror attacks and foreign policy activities. It doesn't mean it's valid. It doesn't mean what they do is legitimate. But to sort of say that, you know, to pretend that there aren't these connections is quite dangerous. It sort of disconnects our foreign policy completely from ordinary life. It implies that everything we do in the foreign sphere has no implications or repercussions in our ordinary lives, and which is very strange way of looking at the world, to say the least.
Right. Yeah, as Ron Paul put it in his great fight with Rudy Giuliani, that if we think we can just go around the world doing whatever we want to whoever we want with no consequences, then we do that at our own peril. I mean, we're putting the American people in danger if we think that people won't resent and fight back against the things we do to them, right as he was pointing out, that this all goes back to long before September 11th. We're bombing Iraq from bases in Saudi Arabia from 1991 all the way through. And that was what brought on the attack in the first place. So what's funny is I see a lot of times people make the argument that you just made and say, you know, it's been counterproductive the way we fight the war. But they never want to go back and say this has all been since 1990 and the occupation of Saudi Arabia, not since the bad reaction in invading Iraq in response to 9/11, et cetera, like that, which is the shorter and easier version of the same story, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, it was a really interesting debate here in the UK. I mean, the debate in Parliament was 10 hours long, and I haven't seen something like that for quite a while. Hundreds of MPs spoke from both sides, and they had some really interesting things to say. And there was a really interesting and strong narrative there around, Islamic State, Daesh, being fascists, being these ultra-extremists who, kill far more Muslims than they ever kill Westerners. Who, their attacks on apostates, on gays, on women that they believe behave unacceptably. In fact, on frankly anyone who they think behaves unacceptably. And that was interesting to sort of hear that and to hear the sort of focus around that. It's and from the left as well. Quite a few on the left here were framing the fight against Daesh, Islamic State, in similar language about the kind of British, French, American fight against the Nazis back in the 1940s. It was interesting to hear those speeches. You don't have to agree with them, but it was interesting to hear that rhetoric.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, man, they're trying to rationalize what it is they're doing. And, of course, just like in World War II, it's really easy to demonize the other side because they really suck. You know what I mean? There's no doubt about it. But
yeah.
But then that's supposed to kind of retroactively justify anything their opponents want to do about it. And, that's where emotions take over and reason subsides and we end up doing the same dumb things again. Same counter, horrible things. I don't want to say dumb because that makes it sound like innocent mistakes. When, some of these guys at least know better. But anyway, so talk to me a bit about the Russians, if you would. You mentioned that
the
Russians are killing a lot more civilians than the Americans are, at least in Syria. Is that right?
That's as far as we know. So, we've spoken about air wars before. We began by just tracking the coalition, but obviously as more and more countries have been drawn into Syria and Iraq to a lesser extent, we felt more and more that we really needed to be looking at all international airstrikes going on there and alleged civilian casualties from all of them. So we took the decision to extend. So we're looking at the Turks and they're bombing the Kurds, the PKK in northern Iraq. And we're also looking at the Russians. There are mornings I wake up and regret that decision, I have to say, mainly because there have been so many allegations about civilians killed in Russian airstrikes. So just to the end of October, we're not even talking about November yet, we have had more than 100 individual incidents in which Russia has allegedly killed civilians, in theory killing as many as 1,300 civilians in just that short time. We don't think the number is that high. You can discount quite a lot of those strikes. They're being overreported for sure. So quite a lot of these strikes turn out to be the Syrian Air Force, or they're contested, or they're simply not Russia. You can show that fairly easily. But enough of them are Russia, we think, to be very worrying indeed. So we think at least 300 civilians or more were killed by the Russians just in their first month of bombing in Syria, and a very high number of injuries as well. And that's a good indicator of the problems with the munitions that the Russians are using. And it's our view that we think the biggest reason Russia's killing so many civilians, it's not just where and when Russia's bombing, but it's what Russia's bombing with. And, there is a lot of hype about it, but these precision munitions that the West tends to use these days, relatively speaking, make life a lot safer for civilians on the ground. And what we're seeing is the Russians using the kind of munitions that we in the West haven't really used for the last 20 years or so. And we're seeing a heck of a lot of deaths and injuries because of those. So it's a very troubling picture that's emerging. There's a very good story in The Guardian tonight, worth everybody having a look at. They've just focused in on one story. It was a Syrian family who went home. They thought it was safe to go home for a short period. And a little girl called Ragad, who was killed along with her uncle and grandfather in almost certainly a Russian airstrike at the very beginning of the Russian air campaign. Heartbreaking story, actually. And, you know, for once putting a very human face on these civilian casualties. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, everything we're seeing coming out of Syria tells us that these Russian casualties are high. Now, there is a kind of weird silver lining to that cloud, in that we are hearing, and there does seem to be some circumstantial evidence to back this up, that the Russians have convinced Assad to stop the barrel bombing. You'll know, Scott, you've been covering this for so long, but the barrel bombing in Syria by the Assad regime has killed so many civilians. They basically, these indiscriminate bombs they chuck out at helicopters onto civilian neighborhoods and kill just vast numbers of ordinary people. As far as we can tell, this is true. We haven't seen reports quite a while now that Russia seems to have convinced Assad to stop the barrel bombing. So in effect, the Russians have become the proxy air force of the Assad regime. Now, so the Russians are still killing a lot of civilians. They're just killing a heck of a lot less civilians than the Syrians would be if it were them carrying out these airstrikes. So It's a kind of weird sort of accounting of war, if you like. But there does seem to be this payoff to the Russians carrying out the strikes. The worst single risk to civilians being the Assad regime. That seems to have slacked off somewhat recently.
Yeah. And that's for now. If his regime were to fall, then obviously the worst threat to the civilians would be the Al-Qaeda guys in the Islamic State and their, you know, head chopping swords for everybody who isn't part of their in-group. We've seen that. But now, so let me ask you this. And just like, you know, with what you were just saying and what we're talking about with the motivation of terrorism, none of this is meant to be a rationalization of any of this. Just trying to get an understanding here. There was a Syrian military base that had been under siege by the Islamic State that the Islamic State were forced to back away from because of Russian air support, I guess, for the Syrian state's military on the ground. But, you know, typically, I don't expect, Chris, for, you know, air power to be able to accomplish much other than kill civilians. You know, you wipe out a group of armed men here or there, it usually doesn't make a difference at all other than maybe driving up recruitment. Anybody that you can get in an airstrike isn't really going to make the difference. Even the decapitation strikes are oftentimes counterproductive when they get the so-called high-value target. They get somebody even worse to replace them and this kind of thing. So I tend to think of, you know, air war is just, it's the coward's way of killing people and looking tough for politics, but not having to risk anybody actually getting hurt since we're fighting against people who don't have an air force and that kind of thing. But then I wonder if maybe a big part of that in this case is because America's policy is so completely ridiculous and schizophrenic, fighting for and against all sides at all times. And what I'm trying to get to here, sorry, is I wonder if you think that since the Russian policy is at least coherent, that they're on the side of the Syrian Baathist government, Hezbollah, and Iran against all comers, that in coordinating with the Syrian army on the ground, unlike America has been willing to do against the Islamic State, for example, do you think that they at least will be able to make some progress and push the Islamic State out of Syria? Or does it look plausible that they might? Or is this all still just a fool's errand, killing for nothing?
Yeah, the problem with that is it assumes that the primary Russian target is Islamic State. And it's clearly, clearly not. Everything we're seeing from these Russian airstrikes shows that the bulk of them, and I would say about 80% of them, are aimed at non-Islamic State groupings.
Well, they're hitting at whoever's closest to their lines first, no, right? They got to
get further east to get to the Islamic State. Way beyond their lines, way beyond their lines. And they're targeting a lot of these so-called moderate groups, you know, the FSA, the sort of allies that the US and others have been cultivating. And it looks like around 80% of those Russian strikes are aimed not at IS. So,
I'm just saying those are the most immediate threat to Assad's regime. Yeah. Whereas you're saying they're far away, but they're not on the other side of the Islamic State from there.
Yeah.
So the IS will be, you know, next on the list.
The catastrophe, and it would be a catastrophe, would be if Assad wins militarily and reconquers Syria. Because this is my own view. This is nothing to do with air wars. You know, air wars doesn't have an opinion on this. But my own view is, you know, 250,000 dead Syrians for nothing and 100,000 men at arms fighting him at the moment, thrown out of that country, routed, you know, whatever. What on earth do we think will happen to the region if Assad wins? There is a line I hear here, and it makes an awful lot of sense that the West's priority, or even the international priority right now, should not be destroying ISIL, contain ISIL for the moment, get peace in Syria, and replace Assad. Because if Assad wins, I really would worry for the region at that point. But that's my own view, you know. Of course, and everybody has a view. And I'm sitting here in the safety of London. I can have any view I want, you know. It's what Syrians need and want that we often hear the least of. There's talk that the Vienna talks may be getting some traction. There might be some movement there. I really hope so. Because, you know, after so many years of this war, you know, so many dead, you know, for God's sake, Syrians need it.
Yeah, no, it is absolutely horrible. And the thing is, I guess I look at it from the point of view of subtracting America out of every equation. And if it wasn't for the Americans having their backs, then the Israelis, the Turks, the Saudis, the Qataris are going to be way out on a limb here and might have to recalculate and figure out whether they want to negotiate or not. Whereas now, as long as they have America to do all their dirty work for them, they have this terrible moral hazard to continue fighting on the jihadist side of the civil war, which frankly, you know, I'm just guessing, but it seems to me like without all their help all this time, including the Americans, Assad would have won this war a long time ago. And there would have been a hell of a lot less dead. And you're right. You're talking about basically the great Bay of Pigs of Syria, you know, leaving the guys, getting them in there, fighting, and then leaving them high and dry, same as Bush Sr. did to the Shia in the desert in 1991, and the Kurds, too, in 1991, when he encouraged them to rise up against Saddam and then left them high and dry, certainly facing that. But then again, the only alternative to that seems to be helping them create an Islamic State.
Yeah,
caliphate.
I don't think you can pin that much on America here. Syria is its own nightmare. And everybody else projects their own stuff onto Syria. That's absolutely true. We've got two superpowers and entire regional power blocks acting out their own stuff on Syria right now. But Syria is its own nightmare. And I don't think you can kind of hang the catastrophe of Syria on the US or on Russia or whatever. That catastrophe is still playing out because it's not burnt out yet. We may add fuel here to the fire or fuel there to the fire. We may help things here. We may help things there. But the nightmare is a Syrian nightmare at its heart. And I often do look at the whole Syria thing, and it is an issue of you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You say, you know, if we hadn't helped Assad, if various parties hadn't intervened, Assad may have triumphed right now. But maybe Islamic State would have triumphed right now, you know, if there hadn't been these interventions. It's so complicated, this country, and there are so many factions and so many elements to it that are almost impossible to understand and navigate. I don't even know where to go at the end of that sentence, Scott, other than to say I don't think we should be that guilty about this. I'm not sure we're getting it right in what we're doing, but I don't think we can, you know, the nightmare of Syria can be hung on us.
Right.
I think we bear some of that responsibility, but as an international community, we bear that responsibility.
Right. All right, we're way over time, and we're about to start the next segment, actually. Thanks so much, Chris. That's airwars.org, y'all. Chris Woods. Thanks,
man.
Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. Just barely hung up on Chris Woods, quite rudely there, before the music kicked in, I hope. I think I made it by a second or two. The great Chris Woods from airwars.org. And yeah, we went way into the top of the hour break there. So if you want to hear the end of that, you'll have to check the archives later on. And now we got to move on because I'm late to get Gareth Porter on the show here. He's got some news analysis for us. That's the one good thing about Skype. Well, the second good thing about Skype, other than the audio quality when it's working right, is, I don't have to stop the show and go make a phone call. I can just hit a button, and it works just right. Welcome back to the show, Gareth Porter. How are you, sir?
Hi, Scott. I'm fine. Good to talk to you again.
This is actually not a record, but this is your third time on the show in a week, but on three very different subjects and very important ones. I don't mind if you don't. Gareth Porter, I've done over 4,000 interviews and 200 and I think now 31 or 2 or 3 or so of those are of him. Because he's great on everything. And he wrote the book, Manufactured Crisis, The Truth Beyond All the Ridiculous Hype About the Iranian Civilian Nuclear Program. Something like that. And so, now, get this, everybody. The International Atomic Energy Agency has finally released their report on Iran's possible military dimensions, otherwise known as the PMD file, all the accusations that Iran had been researching and or attempting to construct nuclear weapons. And this is part of the nuclear deal, is that the Iranians will cooperate with the IAEA on resolving all the last of these questions, and they have, and now this is the IAEA's report, and guess what? Gareth read it and has some criticism. Welcome back. I already said that. So tell us, first of all, can you give us the basic overview, give us the Gareth Porter headline out of the IAEA PMD report here, Gareth?
Well, you know, this is a tough piece to write in the sense that there really are two entirely different levels on which it needs to be discussed. At one level, to give some sense of the history of the whole issue for context, and as well as, you know, what the significance of this document is for the agreement. I'm sorry, hold on.
No problem. Yeah, there is. It's a technical issue and a political one for sure, so.
Right. But the other story is really what is, spectacularly different about this, document, this final assessment that reveals the inside sort of the modus operandi of the IAEA, the dishonest modus operandi of the organization in dealing with the whole Iran nuclear issue. And in order to do both of those, you really need a lot more than the normal size story. And so it was really tough for me. I had to make a choice here. And I finally decided to focus on the latter, to focus on what I thought was the headline in terms of the issue that the IAEA spectacularly misrepresented, that I think most of your listeners will be familiar with, and that's the Parchin, the infamous bomb test cylinder of Parchin, what I call in my book the phantom bomb test cylinder of Parchin, and how the IAEA handled that in this report is, in my view, a scandal. And so I made the headline something to, you know, the effect that the IAEA defends discredited Parchin story even though it essentially backtracked. I didn't have space to put the backtrack in there, but that's part of the lead. So what I did was to really show that what the IAEA the lie that the IAEA has added to its list on this issue is that it defended the overall notion that it was right about the Parchin bomb cylinder, even though if you read it carefully, what you discover is that the IAEA actually backtracked on the key points that it had relied upon in the past to buttress the notion that this bomb cylinder, this phantom bomb cylinder, actually existed. On one hand, I document in this piece that the IAEA, in its famous 2011 report, where it made all these accusations based on intelligence claims by unidentified member states. Exactly. Clearing throat. Meaning Israel plus Israel's friends. What the IAEA did in that 2011 report was to say that the unnamed member states had told it that this cylinder had been installed in 2011 to carry out hydrodynamic testing. Now, hydrodynamic testing means essentially simulated nuclear testing, which does not use any nuclear material. And so this was, you know, quite a spectacular claim. And what we find in the actual, in the final report is that they don't even claim that anymore. They now do not attribute the idea of hydrodynamic testing to these, unknown, unidentified member states. Now they're basically admitting that this whole idea that the bomb chamber was put there for hydrodynamic testing was an inference from the dimensions of the chamber, or from the dimensions of the cylinder. I mean, this is an astonishing admission, even though it's...
But of what cylinder? The dimensions of what cylinder?
Well, they're talking about the dimensions of, they're talking about the dimensions of a cylinder that was designed by, the Ukrainian scientist, who they identify as falsely as somebody who worked in a bomb program and therefore was in fact a specialist on nuclear weapons in the Soviet Union. I mean, he did work in the Soviet Union, but in fact he was never a specialist on nuclear weapons, didn't know anything about nuclear weapons design or anything like that. So what he did was to work on As I think some of your listeners, many of your listeners will remember, he worked on nanodiamonds. And so he had designed a nanodiamond production, cylinder. And they cited, in fact, in their 2011 report, the fact that in this publication, he had identified the dimensions of this cylinder. And therefore, this was the basis for deciding that this was how big the alleged cylinder at Parchin was. So this is just an astonishing series of bold assumptions that are passed off as fact.
And now, but so Dan Alenko never did actually even make a chamber for the Iranians for nanodiamonds or anything else. He had just designed one. Is that it?
There's absolutely no evidence that he ever designed, that he ever actually built a chamber for it.
Never was an actual chamber. Just they're going off of what they claim are the specs that.
That's right.
Around in a circle with the assertions there from the Israelis.
I have never seen one iota of evidence to support the idea that Danilenko actually, constructed a chamber of any kind in Iran.
And now it's important here too, and you get into tungsten and all this and that, and Robert Kelly, he's the former IAEA chief inspector, and you can talk more about his credentials if you want when we get back from the break. But he did a report for SIPRI, SIPRI.org, where he shows what this thing would have had to look like and be like if it had existed, right, according to the claims, and shows just how absolutely impossible it is to believe that that thing was built and then demolished and removed without everybody in the whole wide world knowing about it. And I'll encourage everybody to go and put their eyeballs on that study for SIPRI.org. We'll be right back with the heroic Gareth Porter in just one second, y'all. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still. If you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. Hey, Al Scott here. On average, how much do you think these interviews are worth to you? Of course, I've never charged for my archives in a dozen years of doing this, and I'm not about to start. But at patreon.com/ScottHortonShow, you can name your own price to help support and make sure there's still new interviews to give away. So what do you think? 2 bits? A buck and a half? There are usually about 80 interviews per month, I guess, so take that into account. You can also cap the amount you'd be willing to spend in case things get out of hand around here. That's patreon.com/ScottHortonShow. And thanks, y'all. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton and all that. I'm talking with the great Gareth Porter. We're deep in the weeds on the new Iran report from the IAEA, the final assessment on past and present outstanding issues regarding Iran's nuclear program, the PMD. And Gareth, in his new piece, which isn't out yet, but it will be very soon here, It's very in-depth on the claims, the very important claims about the Parchin military facility and hydrodynamic testing that was alleged to have taken place in a giant containment chamber that was alleged to have existed. And now the IAEA is saying that they're still right, even though they're climbing down big time from, I guess, all of the different arguments that they had ever clung on to in order to argue the case for believing in this chamber and these tests. So I'm not exactly sure where you want to pick it up here, Gareth, but I'll give the floor back to you.
You alluded to the to a SIPRI study by Bob Kelly, Kelly. And of course, he's done several things, about the infamous chamber at the bomb test chamber at Parchin, all of which have effectively debunked it in one way or another. But the latest thing that he did in October for SIPRI is a short research note or discussion note in which he addressed this whole question of the use of tungsten as the substitute for nuclear material in hydrodynamic testing, which, you know, the 2011 report specifically mentioned tungsten as the candidate that they were told by their apparently by their unnamed member state sources was how the chamber would be used for hydrodynamic testing, that they would use tungsten, which was alleged to be similar in its characteristics to uranium for that purpose. Now, what Kelly did was to absolutely just explode this whole notion that tungsten could be used for hydrodynamic testing. He shows that it's ridiculous. It's stupid. Basically, it's impossible that you would use tungsten. He points out that it can't be shaped. It can't be melted and shaped into the form that would be needed for hydrodynamic testing because of its fundamental characteristics, which are totally different from uranium, and that the form in which it could be transformed into, which is a powder, requires an incredibly complex and expensive process that would be not worth it. And furthermore, and even more importantly, you wouldn't learn anything worthwhile from using tungsten because its characteristics are so different from those of uranium. So the whole idea he just completely debunks. And this was published in mid-October, as I recall. Mm. And what is so interesting here about the final assessment is that the IAEA no longer even mentions tungsten. implicitly acknowledging that that was bunk. And I mean, they still mention hydrodynamic testing, but don't don't mention anything else about it.
Amazing.
And so, you know, this is further evidence that, you know, they're a bit shamefaced about this privately, but they're not willing to admit that they were wrong.
Yeah. Well, I should ask Gordon Prather about that. I know he told me before that it's conceivable that they could use non-fissile uranium or even lead maybe for tests like that. Not that they would do it in a chamber anyway. If they were testing an implosion system, they would do that outside, like in the bogus accusations about Marivan, not in a chamber like the bogus accusations about Parchin.
But. Right. So that brings me to the other point that I make in this piece, you know, about the final assessment in relation to Parchin and similar issues, because, you know, the not the hydrodynamic testing, but another form of supposed nuclear-related testing involving high explosives that the IAEA accused Iran of carrying out in its 2011 report is something that involves a technology that involves a multi-point detonation system, or PMI. And so you know, this is much more complicated. The IAEA argued or claimed that Iran again used the famous Ukrainian scientist engineer to help them rig up this this technology that they could test, that they could use to see if they could detonate a nuclear weapon. The Iranians came back finally in the final phase of this cooperation, and they documented the fact that, yes, they had a PMI technology under development, but they documented the fact that it was used for a conventional weapons application, and they presented a lot of documentation to prove that. And the IAEA does not challenge that fact. And so all they have as their final assessment on the whole question of this technology that they had previously blown up into such a huge issue of, you know, having a program that looked like it was a nuclear weapons related program. Now they say, yes, Iran did have this program, but the technology, well, they don't even say but the technology has characteristics that are relevant to nuclear weapons. I mean, nice. That is, of course, a totally meaningless statement.
Yeah.
And that is another way in which they sort of get away with backtracking without having to admit it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you've reported before that they were invited out to Marivan and refused to go because they know they're full of it.
That's the final point I wanted to make, and you've anticipated it perfectly. Yes, this was – in the 2011, the sort of keynote of their accusation was that they had information from member states that, in fact, this technology, alleged nuclear weapons related technology was carried out. The testing was carried out at a place called Marivan, a region of Marivan. So finally, in late 2014, the Iranians said, okay, fine, come. We'll let you have a one-time visit to Marivan just to see if, in fact, there's any evidence that such testing was carried out. And, of course, as you say, the IAEA refused to go, even though this was the one place where, you know, they had identified specific tests that had been carried out, according to their, again, unidentified member state sources. They refused to go and carry out an inspection or to see, you know, to carry out any environmental sampling at the site. And they never explained why. They simply said, well, we don't think this would answer the questions. So it's obviously extremely suspicious, and it once again just underlines the dishonesty of the IAEA on this whole set of issues.
Mm-hmm. All right. And now, and nobody forget, in case you never heard it too, learn it now, that it's in the WikiLeaks, where Yuki Amano, the head of the IAEA, coming in replacing Mohammed El-Baradei, said, hey, guys, on Iran, I'm with you and your agenda, whatever you want out of me, that kind of thing. So it's not just an accusation. It's right there. Thank you, Chelsea Manning, doing 35 years in the brig for our government sins, for revealing this information to us. But it's there if anybody wants to check it in the State Department's own writing about our great victory in putting this tool of ours in charge there. And furthermore,
just very quickly to add a point to that, one of my sources, a former IAEA source who was in a position to know this, says that former colleagues told him that Amano had said privately that he had no choice but to issue the 2011 report with all these accusations because it was part of the deal under which he got U.S. support to be elected to the position of director general to replace El-Baradei, to succeed El-Baradei.
Wow, he admitted that openly. I wonder what his ancestors think of that.
They wouldn't be too proud if they were samurai, as by the way, he also told people in the IAEA that he was a samurai. But if his Japanese ancestors were samurai, they would not be pleased with that.
Yeah, representing the Israelis, a little far afield from their usual stomping grounds there, I guess. All right, well now, so back to Parchin for a second here, as long as I'm keeping you into the break. They found two particles of uranium. Gareth, natural uranium, but still uranium with a capital U. So how do you explain that, Mr. Apologist?
Absolutely. I'm glad you've come back to that, circled back to it, because that is another link here, another way in which the IAEA essentially misrepresented the issue of what they know and what they found at Parchin. They have a footnote to the text. A footnote to a statement in which they attack the Iranian explanation for what the actual purpose of the building at Parchin, at that site at Parchin was, which was to store not unused vats or drums of chemicals that they were used for explosive experiments there. And they attack that, and in the footnote, to their statement that they found, no evidence of that would show that there were chemicals stored there. And of course, that in itself is misleading because there's no reason to believe that they would have found evidence simply because drums of chemicals were stored there. They wouldn't necessarily find any evidence that they were there. But the footnote, as you point out, admits that they found no evidence of uranium that they could link to a nuclear program. They found two particles, which was simply not an indication of that there was anything, that there's any actual man-made or man-changed uranium that was there in the site. And that is significant because...
Wait, you're saying, in plain English here, you're saying... Two particles proves the negative. It doesn't establish, anything. It only shows what there's not. That's all there is.
They essentially admit that in their footnote. But what they do not say is that the significance, the real significance of that finding is that there was no hydrodynamic testing because to do so, the Iranians, had they been involved in something like that, they would have had to use uranium, natural uranium. And that would have shown up in the environmental sample. If they had carried out an explosion using natural uranium, that would have shown up.
All right. What about lead? Did they test for lead at all? Again, I'm just going on hearsay, but it's the very best hearsay. The great Gordon Prather said he thinks that it's conceivable that someone could do implosion system testing with lead or natural uranium.
I've never heard anything about that. I'm trusting Bob Kelly on this. He is, as far as I'm concerned, among the handful of top specialists on intelligence on nuclear weapons programs.
And
so
he never mentions that at all, huh?
Yeah, no.
And the IAEA doesn't either.
No.
All right. Well, as long as they're not using this as one of their bogus arguments, I guess it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
All right. Well, so in other words, they really climbed down from all the accusations, but just still at the end sort of stubbornly said, we refuse to admit we're wrong. But anyway, let's move ahead anyway. The PMD issue is closed. Is that right?
Well, look, Scott, I mean, what they did in this report on both of these issues and on other issues is that they use a lot of very cleverly formulated language, which is ambiguous and which makes it sound superficially like they're finding reaffirms their initial finding in 2011. But in fact, if you read it very carefully in the context of what they say specifically, it doesn't do that at all. And I think there are a lot of, if I'd had, 4,000 words or 3,000 words, in which to cover all this and the time to do so, I could have given other examples of exactly how they did it. But that's really the modus operandi that they use in order to escape from what is essentially a debacle for the IAEA politically.
Yeah. All right. Listen, so I hope then we can expect another piece or two from you on the rest of the report.
Well, I'm not committing myself to that.
Go ahead, commit.
Right now, because there's so much stuff going on in the Middle East that really has to be addressed. And I don't know if I can get anybody to publish a piece like that. Tell you the truth. That's a question mark.
Well, look, I mean, if nobody will publish it, we'll at least put it on antiwar.com, but we won't give you any money.
Right. And I've got to weigh and balance my time and energy at this point.
I understand. But all right. Well, there you go. I hope that I'll tell you what. Do me a favor and reread it one more time and see if you're not inspired to go ahead and spill out a few more paragraphs.
I'll still be thinking about that. And I can't say that I won't do something. Absolutely. At this point, I just don't know.
All right. Well, listen, man, you're great. I appreciate it. This one is going to run at Middle East Eye. Am I right?
No, this is a truth out.
This is a truth out. Okay, it's IAEA final report defends discredited Parchin cylinder claims by Gareth Porter.
It should be out today. My sense is that it'll be out today.
Okay, good deal. And that's truthout.org by the great Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, The Truth Behind the Iranian Nuclear Scare. Thanks again, Gareth. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Scott.
All right, y'all. And so, hey, cool, we're in the middle of a segment. I can keep talking. I wanted to make this clear. It came up during that Chris Woods interview, guys. Here's the footnote if you need it yourself about Donald Trump saying that we got to target the families of, and he didn't just say the Islamic State. I think, maybe in context that's what he meant, but it seemed like he was being broader than that. And he was saying, look, when you get these terrorists, well, here, I got the clip again, don't I? Have it here. I played it once. It's at thehill.com. You got to kill their families, he says. Listen.
You know, they're using them as shields. It's a horrible thing. They're using them as shields. But we're fighting a very politically correct war.
Yeah. Well, we see that
and the other thing
is
with the terrorists, you have to take out their families. When you get these terrorists, you have to take out their families.
I wish the clip went on because I'd like to see more of the reaction. They're kind of looking at him like, gee, I don't know. Even the Fox News, Fox Friends in the Morning idiots are like, gee. Or maybe they're like, yeah, you're right. This is that serious of a problem where now we have to deliberately target children. Wait, what? I thought this was a war for Western civilization. Wasn't somebody claiming that? You want to argue that the Americans are not the barbarians in this one? I don't know, guys. The premise is wearing thin. That's all I'm saying. And you know what? I don't care if people think that this sounds like some kind of right-wing or Republican or conservative or Christian talking point or something like that. But Bill Clinton is a rapist. And it's a serious flaw in your, wonderful, better than everyone, exceptional state that's so exceptional that it can kill everybody, where you put an actual face-biting rapist in your presidency and then back again. We're going to have Bill Clinton be our first lady for 8 years. And look, I'm not trying to play down the Waco massacre or the cover-up of the Oklahoma bombing and how the FBI was in on it from the beginning. I'm not trying to play down the million people he killed in Iraq, half of them children, sent his Secretary of State out on TV to gloat about it, provoking the terrorist war against the United States and doing virtually nothing to prevent it. The former impeached president of the United States, the scum of the earth. And the fact that he and his wife are even in the running to be back in the presidency? You know what? I don't know, man. You know what? I used to actually have a list. I remember doing a show on Free Radio Austin in 1998 where I was like, okay, here's my Clinton and Reno hate list. And it was like, it was on the back of a taxi cab receipt. Like a 5,000 things I hate about these scum. I wish I could remember them all off the top of my head right now. And I know that Bill Clinton savagely raping a woman and biting her on the face sounds kind of personal. Well, you know, politicians make mistakes. That is a personal problem, this and that. Except I would remind you that in our society, no, rape is treated as a public offense, and the people versus you will put you in prison for raping somebody. Why, that's an offense against the peace and order of this state and will not be allowed when anybody else does it. And you know what? When Bill Clinton savagely raped and bit Juanita Broderick on the face, he was the Attorney General of Arkansas. He was the Attorney General of Arkansas. And here's the thing. Go and watch her interview with Lisa Myers, and I believe that you will believe that she is not lying. She's not lying. You better put some ice on that, darling. You think she could make that up about him? That's what he said to her? And there was a cooperating witness to one degree or another, and I don't remember the entire story, but I think her friend's name was Tamara, who had found her on the bed with her pantyhose ripped, crying, with her upper lip swollen out as far as her nose. That was the story. And she did not make any money. She did not write a book. She did not sue for money. The only lawsuit she was ever involved in about it on her end was suing for her FBI file, not for a single dollar. Because you know Bill Clinton sicked the FBI on her. And she told the story of how she'd always lied about it and always had just kept it to herself, and everybody had known it was true, basically, and the story had been around, and that the Republicans in Arkansas and otherwise had tried to get her to come forward against Bill Clinton for years and years, and she wouldn't do it. And the only reason that she, and in fact, in the Paula Jones lawsuit, this is how she ended up being part of the story, was in the Paula Jones deposition, she lied, just like Bill Clinton. She committed perjury then, and said that, no, the whole thing never happened. And then later on, what happened was she was subpoenaed to go testify before the federal grand jury. And as she explained to Lisa Myers in her interview, her son was a lawyer. And her son told her, hey, listen, a federal civil deposition is a big deal, but you can absolutely not lie to a federal grand jury. You just can't. I don't care how bad it hurts or how bad you don't want to do it or how bad you want to remain Jane Doe, whatever the hell, you have to tell the truth to a federal grand jury, period. And she said, okay, that was it. And so finally she admitted the truth to Ken Starr's grand jury. And then Lisa Myers interviewed her about it. And I think her story is absolutely credible. And you couldn't have made that stuff up. She had no reason to make that stuff up. And if NBC hadn't corruptly sat on that interview, then Bill Clinton may very well have been removed from office. Because the senators who voted to convict him were the senators who had read her deposition, many of them, read her testimony before the grand jury and said, no way, man, we got to put an end to this thing. And so anyway, aren't you looking forward to another 8 years of Bill Clinton? Everybody loves it. Everybody thinks of the 90s as the good old days, like it was the roaring 20s or something. Yeah, big fake bubble, I'll give you that. What the hell is wrong with my connection to Freak Talk here, man? Let's see here. It's not my fault when these things happen. It's somebody else's.
Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours, max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our status enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.